Okay, how you doing out there tonight? Good evening to you. It's great to be back in Dallas. It's only been about 22 years. But we're glad to be here. We have a great new band, the Citizen Steely Dan Orchestra for 94. We've got some great players here. We're going to introduce them to you as we continue right now. Here's a tune from Gaucho. It's called Hey 19.
Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today, I am joined by Evan and Ian of the Jokerman podcast. It started off a few years ago as a podcast about Bob Dylan, but has now shifted its focus to Lou Reed and John Cale. Evan and Ian also co-host a podcast called Neverending Stories, which is about Bob Dylan bootlegs. And today's episode is kind of a crossover because we are also talking about a bootleg, and the episode is kind of in the style of Jokerman, so it's something of a crossover episode. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a message, I believe from Ian, asking me if I wanted to be on Jokerman podcast. I hadn't done any podcasting at the time. I am a very casual Bob Dylan fan, so, you know, I don't think I could do a whole episode only about Bob Dylan. So I let him know. I said, you know, I'd be happy to do it, but, you know, I don't know how much I could bring to the table, really. But he said, don't worry about it. I ended up listening to a little bit of Jokerman, and I really liked it. It was funny and kind of irreverent, and you know, like me, they are, you know, of the millennial generation, and they're kind of taking on artists who are not of our generation. So we're kind of doing a similar thing in a way, even though, you know, at the time mine was just a Twitter account. But yeah, I went on. We did an episode about Two Against Nature, because that's kind of the way they do it. They each episode focuses on an album, and it's usually in the late period of an artist's career. I believe at the time, they hadn't done any other episodes other than ones about Bob Dylan. So that was the first time they left the Dylan sphere to do another artist. And now they've done that a bunch of times. But yeah, I had a really fun time doing that Two Against Nature episode. And I actually ended up going back a few more times. We also did an episode about the Nightfly. And then I believe a year ago, we did our episode on Walter Becker's 1994 11 Tracks of Whack. So, of course, you know, when I was starting this podcast, I thought, well, I definitely want to have the Jokerman boys come and do my podcast. And because we had such a great time doing that Walter episode, it was actually Ian's idea to do this live at the Starplex. It's a bootleg from 1994 where they perform Down at the Bottom, which is Ian's favorite song on 11 Tracks of Whack. I really, really love this show, and I thought it would be fun to do an episode, you know, completely dedicated to like one live show. So yeah, I agreed, and we did it. Now, because there were three of us, I guess we kind of went long. So what I've done is I've split this episode into two. I was also planning on taking a gap week next week. So instead of the gap week, what I've done is I basically split the episode into two parts. And, you know, this way I didn't have to edit it so tightly that it would leave a lot of the best stuff on the cutting room floor. And also lets me, you know, play all the great clips from the show and include those. So without further ado, this is the first half of my conversation with Evan and Ian of the Jokerman podcast. Enjoy. obviously it started with you guys being Bob Dylan fans.
That's right.
Connecting yeah. with that, but
started well, because we had nothing better to do. Well, and it has continued because we don't have anything better to do.
That's reductive, Ian. It's happened because that was sort of true. But also, it's now the only thing we can think of to do, probably. So it's leveled up.
In some ways.
I think that, I mean, I did originally just like conceive of that there should be a show called Jokerman that talked about Bob Dylan in the like later period. And then I forgot about it. And then Ian and I just started doing it. Like we were actually just talking about Bob Dylan because the new album at the time, Rough and Rowdy Ways, was coming out. And then I just remembered that that was an idea I had had, and it was just happening.
So that was that was the impetus, was Rough and Rowdy Ways?
It kind of reignited it. Yeah.
The first episodes came out like, I think, 2 days before Rough and Rowdy Ways came out in June 2020. And so it was all serendipitous that way.
Peak pandemic time and people were desperate for content, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. desperate for Bob Dylan music and desperate for idiots to talk about Bob Dylan music as well. But I think it ended up, I'll be the first to say that the first, 6 months or so, the show is tough sledding at times. Yeah. But we eventually kind of figured out what we were doing, and over time have, adopted the Jokerman mindset concept, which has allowed us to apply the same sort of lens to other artists as well, such as Steely Dan. And that was actually the very first non-Bob episode that we ever did, was with you talking to Against Nature, like a year into the show. So that was, Evan picked, he wanted to do a Van Morrison episode for the first non-Bob. I wanted to do Steely Dan for the first non-Bob. So that was our first steps outside of the Bob verse, which
now we've done both several times over.
Yes. And we're going to continue.
I think just to explain briefly the Jokerman mindset concept, it would just be what would you say? And I think the confidence, the assured faith that the records that are in a later section of an artist's career who you loved or love their early work, that there's going to be something you will love in those later ones. If you truly loved them, if they were really great. And it's always true. It just ends up being true that like the people who blew your mind are typically capable. They can do it again. It'll just maybe be in a different way and with more gray hair and terrible art direction choices.
Or great art direction choices, as covered extensively on the 11 Tracks of Whack episode that we did with you, Alex, which is just some iconic 1994-ass fucking imagery from top to bottom.
Yeah, maybe terrible in the eyes of the Philistine public, but to those with the true believers,
right? With an advanced enough palate, you can really unlock just a new flavor profile that you're not going to get in any other circumstances. Yeah, I mean it's just if it's an artist that you loved and that really means the world to you and really did achieve something legit, which Bob obviously qualifies, as do Don and Walt, it's acknowledging and expecting that same person is behind the shit that was there at the beginning and right up to present day. And so it doesn't make any sense to write them off and decide that there's an arbitrary point in time where like I'm only going to pay attention to Lou Reed, for instance, who we're talking about right now on the show, the main show, until 1978, like certain Instagram accounts out there. And then everything out of that, after that, I'm just going to, pretend it doesn't exist. It's just that's not the way to look at it.
The idea being that like there's, you have some kind of side of the bargain, I think, as a listener. Like if you get so much out of music by certain artists, that then like the least you can do is kind of keep up with what they want to do. It's like being at a show when the band is playing, like, I want to play some new songs. Are you going to be the type who boos, or are you going to be the type who tries to listen to the song and see what they're so excited about?
Well, I mean, I think so. You know, one thing that I have in common with each of you is that we're kind of both doing, you know, a tribute, homage, whatever you want to call what we do in terms of our relationship with these bands or artists that are, you know, from a previous generation, right? Because that's, you know, Bob, Lou, you know, they're really more from, you know, if you want to say the boomer generation or our parents' generation, you know, maybe, you know, early Gen X. But I feel like, you know, coming to these artists at this late stage in the game, you can sort of take this like macro view of their entire career and see it in a different perspective. So, like, I know my parents, you know, a lot of the artists that you cover, as well as, you know, Steely Dan and Donald Fagen, they kind of checked out, you know, sometime in the 80s. Like, you know, my parents are both huge Bob Dylan fans. Like, we had tons of Bob Dylan in our house growing up, but I don't know how many Bob Dylan albums after like 1983, I guess, was that when Infidels came out?
Yeah, fair
The
enough.
impetus of Joker Man. Yeah, I don't know how many albums after that that we, you know, they would ever throw on. So I feel like, you know, part of this thing that we're doing is kind of like, you know, just, like I said, like coming to it, you know, from a later point in the game, you're able to kind of see everything in a different light, and just, you know, coming to it from, you know, a different generational perspective. You know, this is something that I was talking to Steven about on our episode, but just like, it's interesting to see how these artists kind of how our perspective of them shifts over time as we get further and further away from, you know, when they were like most beloved or most, you know, played on the radio, most famous. So
Most alive.
yeah, well, that too. I mean, and Steely Dan's a great example of a band that was like kind of hated in, you know, in certain, you know, music circles for years, and now they've kind of been, I don't know, reclaimed or reappreciated. And one interesting thing about the circle of artists that you have, you know, chosen to focus on. So you have Bob Dylan, you have Lou Reed and John Cale. I don't know if previous generations would have included Steely Dan with those artists. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
they would not have been part of that mix. So do you know why Steely Dan is now, do you know why you chose to incorporate Steely Dan into the Jokerman mindset, into the Jokerman universe, or whatever you want to call it?
I think there's something about the show like that we all listen to, which is a good example. There's something about like looking at what Steely Dan themselves did when they played in their later years, which is, I think, has something to do with this. Which is that their own attitude, you know, they only had a few albums, like a handful, and they spent a lot of time not with those records, like not making music as Steely Dan, and then returned to it with this retrospective eye of to their own work. And I think their attitude toward it actually was part of what set them up to be to feel relevant now. I think they have this kind of slight irreverence while also taking it totally seriously. Whatever their attitude is about Steely Dan, like Steely Dan's own view of itself, I think it's appealing to just a lot of people, and it feels contemporary. It's like they were ahead of the game in being able to look at their own work from that bird's eye view and kind of meta commentary, like them playing it and doing those songs is in its own way like a way of bringing them, making them feel new again. It's sort of like the, you know, doing a bit until it stops being a bit thing for a lot of
It
people. Like that's kind of the
is,
way people
yeah.
get in.
And I think they were even, you know, and we're going to talk about obviously the 1994 concert, September 2nd, 1994, live at the Starplex Amphitheater in Dallas, Texas,
That's right.
which none of the songs during this performance made it onto their 1995 live album, Alive in America, which was a big album. But for my money, all of this sounds significantly better than anything that ended up on that. I don't know if it's how that live album was, you know, produced or what went into it, but I, you know, I greatly prefer the sound and also just being able to hear an entire concert start to finish. That's one thing I always have not been able to stand about live albums, is that, you know, it's kind of incomplete and they take a few songs from this show and a few songs from this show. But yeah, so I love this con. This is probably my favorite, like, this may be my single favorite, like, bootleg concert that exists of Steely Dan, period. I mean, not including, you know, the small number of shows we have from the early Rock Band years, from 72 to 74. There's not much out
right
there,
before they stopped touring.
Yeah, there's only a handful, and only, you know, I would say two are very good, and then there's a few more that are like okay. But then, you know, the 90s, there's quite a few that are quite good, and this one, I, for my money, is the best one. So
yeah, this one sounds amazing. I mean, we're doing a separate show now, the Never Ending Stories, where we're doing all Bob Dylan bootlegs, and we actually did do a Dan bootleg from 2000 as well. So we're, you know, we're getting used to just listening to dog shit sounding music and saying like, oh, this is good. But this, you don't need to worry about that on this. This sounds as clean as
it's so
as
crisp.
Clean as you can get from an official release. And I was listening to Live in America earlier today too, just to sort of brush up on that. And I think you're totally right about that. I mean, just if that's all that you have, if that's all that you ever get, you know, it's, I'm not gonna turn my nose up at that. That's great stuff. But there is sort of an airless quality to it. Yeah. You know, it's kind of almost generic feeling, a lot of the state, there is no stage banter really, and there isn't really a way that the shows or the songs flow from one to the other, because actually all those songs are taken from different shows over the course of like a year's worth of touring, basically. So it is a live album in some senses, but it isn't like a real live album as a document of a show, and that's what this bootleg really is. This is kind of the best of both worlds as far as I'm concerned, because it is as clean and crisp as you're going to get from an official release, but you also get tons of fucking stage banter and patter between Don and Walt and the band and the audience. It's just and I can't think of two artists better suited for a live album that allows them to just like bant with one another and riff and shuck and jive up there than Don and Waltz.
Yeah, it begs the question, like, if there were two Bob Dylans, would they be like doing stuff like that? Like, when either
they wouldn't be able
alone,
to handle it.
I mean, when Walt is alone or Don, like, I don't know that they're as talkative. Did they do solo shows?
Yes. So there is one, I believe, one recording of a Walter solo show from 1995.
Jesus, I gotta dig that up.
Oh boy.
It shouldn't be funny to me.
That could be a future episode, maybe.
That should be what we're talking. Let's forget this one. Let's just go straight to the
Walter
1995
is...
bootleg.
I'd have to go straight to the bottom. Yeah.
I've been kind of saving that one for a rainy day. I've done like a quick playthrough, but I believe that's the only one of Walt's. I mean, he might have done three or four total, and then that one was the one that somehow ended up on YouTube.
The trouble on the left, trouble on the right, trouble in front of you. My yellow man is still my mellow man. You know what you got to do. No mistake, my friend, the senior in. I should take it out of you. But buddy, it's the skin. Where do I come in? Too big and down in you.
Did during the 90s is a really interesting kind of thing, right? Because they do reform as Steely Dan band, and become a touring
Steely
concern.
Steely Dan band.
Citizen Steely Dan band, as Don says during the bootleg. I think they started that in like 93, right?
Yeah.
92, something like that.
Well, they had reformed, or they had reunited for a bit as the New York Rock and Soul Review. And
that's right.
And that kind of kicked off, you know, the reunion. And then in 1993 is when they launched, you know, the full on, you know, Steely Dan playing the arenas, Madison Square Garden, you know, touring the country, big band.
Big, yeah, back
big back in
like
band
this.
With, you know, three saxophones, you know, two guitarists. And yeah, that kind of, I mean, the 93 and 94 tours kind of created the blueprint for what became, you know, the Steely Dan live experience that is, you know,
right.
Even now that, you know, sadly Walter has passed, is still going. And in addition to that, there are now dozens. It could be over 100 of Steely Dan cover bands that have popped up all over the country. Well, it's actually a worldwide phenomenon. There, you know, Steely Shodan in Japan. There's the Dutch Royal Scam. I mean, it's crazy, and they emulate this kind of big band Steely Dan format with, you know, the 10 to 12, you know, member big band jazz, you know, the smooth jazz version of Steely Dan, which, you know, the incredible thing about this is that they're basically playing music that was never intended to be performed live necessarily, right?
Yes.
So the first three Steely Dan albums, Can't Buy a Thrill, Countdown to Ecstasy, and Pretzel Logic, those were all being recorded with the knowledge that they were going to take that music on tour. And they were kind of more of a traditional rock band, right? It was, you know, the people who played on that album played, you know, on the tour, and it wasn't like these musicians, you know, gun for hires. But obviously, you know, Katie Lied, The Royal Scam, Asia, and Gaucho were all, you know, those were just, you know, studio albums that were never played live at the time. So I guess the obstacle or the challenge of, you know, bringing all this music back was, how are we going to do this live? And this, you know, like I said, the 93 and 94, these tours leading up to the release of Alive in America, created the blueprint for what, you know, is now kind of, you know, we know as the Steely Dan live experience.
Right. Yeah, what Steely Dan means to more people, probably, or just as many people, as the original records do at this point, because this like version of Steely Dan has been an ongoing, off and on, mostly on, for like 30 years at this point. It's 2023. Don just played shows last year as Steely Dan. And so, yeah, it's been 30 years since the 93 launch of this kind of thing. And that's, you know, the original run obviously was over in seven or something like that. So Steely Dan, the legend, you know, is the, you know, cocaine sniffing, just extremely bad vibes, you know, studio perfectionist shit from 72 to 80. But Steely Dan in reality for many people is this enormous, you know, rock and roll, you know, jazz fusion revue that they put on and tour around the country.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, not to get into it, but there have been criticisms of the band as being, like you just said, Ian, like that they're kind of these tyrannical hermit-like freaks who just put musicians to through the ringer again and again, like Stanley Kubrick making actors do 80 shots of a scene. And while there might be some truth to that, I feel like the fact that this exists and has existed for so long should dispel that, kind of. Like, they did feel loose enough to just go out and actually do it, free enough to do it, and they have done it and done it and done it and done it, just in front of everyone.
Well, and so that actually leads me to the question I was going to ask you, Alex. Like, this band, like, comes together in 93, 94, and they start touring, right, and they're bringing all the old hits back. But then Kamakiriad and 11 Tracks of Whack both come out in 94, and those are credited to Don and Walt individually. But in reality, they're like basically secret Steely Dan records, because Walter is all over Kamakiriad and Don is on 11 Tracks of Whack. And then they don't do anything, you know, for another 6 years in terms of studio LPs, and then finally come back with Two Against Nature. So it just, like, what I'm confused is why, or what I'm wondering, you know, and I still haven't struck upon a solid answer yet, is just like why Kamakiriad and 11 Tracks of Whack are Donald Fagen and Walter Becker records instead of there being two additional studio Steely Dan records from the 90s, you know?
Yeah, if I had to guess, it would be that they, enough of the creative involvement of each was fairly limited. Like, yes, they were involved, and I know Walter produced Kamakiriad, but I feel like a lot of the songs were written by Donald, you know, alone, or and vice versa for Walter. But so
Kamakariad is a concept album, and basically, I mean, yeah, I think it, yeah, I like that they're not Steely Dan records.
Loosely a concept
I mean,
album.
They are. I mean, the fact that you know what I'm talking about, that it's like based on like a steampunk car or whatever. I like that they're not Steely Dan records for the reason that it helps give some stature to a record that could use it, like 11 Tracks of Black. Like, I like thinking of that as just Walt's thing. It's great that there is such a thing of just that's the Walter Becker album, one of two, by the way.
And knowing what, you know, a few years down the road when they recorded Two Against Nature and Everything Must Go, yes, those records are different than, you know, they're significantly different than the sort of original run of Can't Buy a Thrill Through Gaucho. But comparing those to Kamakariad and 11 Tracks of Whack, those feel a lot closer to Steely Dan records, where to me, 11 Tracks of Whack and Kamakariad feel quite different from one another, especially Kamakariad just feels a lot closer. Again, now we have this macro view where I can look at all the Donald Fagen albums and I can look at all the Steely Dan albums. Kamakariad feels, you know, very much like a Donald Fagen solo album.
Yeah, the Nightfly. If you did cherry pick tracks from each of those, you probably could piece together something like a Steely Dan record. And there is something to be said for that. The fact that they do that here in the show.
Yeah, exactly. You absolutely can do that because this Steely Dan show includes songs from Kamakariad and from 11 Tracks of Whack.
And it feels natural. It actually works perfectly fine.
Well, here's what's interesting that I want to get this part out of the way because this has kind of been, you know, sticking in my craw a little bit. So I was digging into some of the set lists and it looks like the first few shows that they did in, I guess it was August of 1993 when they kicked off the reunion tour. This is before the big New York City shows, but like when they were doing, I think the first few shows were in like Detroit and then maybe Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot more Donald and Walter solo songs in the set.
Wow.
And it looks like after a handful of shows, and I'm guessing this was because of muted audience reaction, they cut down on that significantly. So I was looking, for example, there is a unfortunately terrible sounding bootleg of the show they'd played at the Palace at Auburn Hills in Michigan, which I think was August 1993, and they played 12, count them, 12 songs from the Donald and Walter solo repertoires. I'm not kidding. Yes.
Can they list them, please?
I can, yes. I actually copied and pasted this before.
You know our shit. I'm glad you're prepared.
I know what you guys are going to be into. So, yeah, it's nuts. So they played. So for Donald, they played a couple Nightfly tracks. They played IGY and Greenflower Street.
Yes. Cool.
Then they played off Kamakariad. You get Trans Island Skyway. You get Tomorrow's Girls. And you get Countermoon. And Tea House.
Countermoon.
And Tea House on the track. So four of the eight. Half
hell
the
yeah.
The song titles are so funny to somebody who's like sort of unfamiliar with the record.
I love Counter Moon is so good. I love Counter
House.
Moon.
Oh, they played Tea House on the tracks.
It's your last chance to learn how to dance at the Tea House on the tracks.
Yeah, they threw Tea House in there at the end. And then from the and then Tracks of Whack galore. So you get Cringe Maker.
Yes.
Girlfriend.
Nice.
You get let's see, Book of Liars.
Beautiful.
Oh, great.
Which is not on the not in the concert we're going to talk about, but was played throughout 93 and 94.
And is on Alive in America.
It is.
Randomly, weirdly, is the one solo track that from either one of them that's on Alive in America.
That one could be a Steely Dan song, I think, in the right context. I mean, yes. Like, one half of Steely Dan. Of course, it's going to be kind of like Steely Dan.
So, and also two tracks of Whack that are not on 11 Tracks of Whack. Two.
Wow.
Please tell me that they played... That they played it. Did they play Hat Too Flat?
They did not. No, that has never been performed live. They played Fall of 92, which actually did make it in to the live repertoire. It's not on the show we're going to talk about, but they played it like, I don't know, 30-something times after this. And this song called Our Lawn, which is
was the last song?
Fall of 92.
Is that a bonus track?
It's not on WAC.
We talked about that at the end of the episode. Yeah. That's the one where he calls Bill Clinton a Nazi or something like that.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. How he refers to all those Nazis down in Washington. Which amazingly actually did make it into the live repertoire, but did not make it onto the album. But Our Lawn, which is not on the album. Our Lawn, yes. It's on YouTube, the finished version.
So two like buried deep cuts. Two buried deep cuts. 6 feet under cuts.
Yeah.
Because these would have been songs that were on no one had heard before ever, right? Because this was 93 and Tracks of WAC and Kamakiri don't come out until the following year. So they get up there and fully half the set is just a bunch of shit that no one knows.
Well, Kamakiri came out in 93, actually.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
I'm pretty sure that had come out. But for the entirety of the 93 tour, the Walter songs were all new for listeners. So now here's the thing. After three or four shows, they cut most of these out. So if you happen to be in the audience at any of those early shows, you were among the only people to ever hear Steely Dan perform, for example, Trans Island Skyway or, Girlfriend.
Counter Moon.
You were one of the disappointed fans.
Counter Moon, actually, they played, they kept in. There's video of that out there. So if you want to hear, if you want to see Counter Moon, that made the cut, but that's not on the show we're going to talk about. But anyway, I felt that was important to address before in there. Yes.
Incredible deep lore. Man, so you'll know better than either of us here. Yeah. So there's this moment in time, obviously, where we're getting some Kamakiri and Tracks of WAC in there. I don't imagine any 21st century Steely Dan live performances have included anything from Morph or Circus Money or Sunken Condos.
Well, there was the Nightfly whole show, but that was separate.
There is actually, but it's not Steely Dan. There was the Donald Fagen Band toured, mm-hmm. and he did a lot of the solo stuff. So he did Nightfly and Kamakiriad, and then he worked in some of the Morph the Cat material.
Beautiful.
So if you're a big fan of Donald solo and you want to go back and check out those bootlegs, there's some great stuff. There's a great show in Toronto that I've listened to a couple times. They do a beautiful Snowbound, which is one of those songs that Steely Dan never performed. So if you're
Snowbound,
if you're hankering, for Snowbound, that's where to go. And then there's been a few other kind of Fagen solo runs. Sprinkled it in, but
What we got to hope for, the 2023 iteration of whatever the Steely Dan, touring schedule becomes. The Don has done those Nights at the Beacon, like all of Royal Scam, all of Asia, all of Gaucho. We got to get one that's all of Nightfly. We got to get one that's just Kamakiriad back to front in sequence, one that's Morph the Cat in sequence back to front, and another one, a fourth one that's Sunken Condos. That's just, I'm going all four.
I'd say there's a shot of the Nightfly happening. I would say that it's highly unlikely that.
Think?
Well, he's working on a new one. They say. He says.
Long rumor.
Word on the street.
That's like his kind of thing, right? It was he gets one out every 8 to 13 years.
Yeah, I mean there was a Rolling Stone article about a year and a half ago where he said that he was basically. He had written a bunch of new songs during the pandemic and was hoping to get back into the studio, but there's been no follow-up to that since. So your guess is as good as mine as whether we're ever going to get a fifth Fagen solo.
We're keeping our fingers crossed here.
All right. Should we dive into the show?
Yeah, let's.
All right.
Yes.
So like I said, this is live at the Starplex Amphitheater. That's how I have it labeled. It's from September 2nd, 1994. And it's, part of the 94 tour. Fantastic lineup. A couple of the reasons that this show stands out for me. One is just, the soundboard recording itself is immaculate, crystalline, whatever words you want to use to describe what a good sounding soundboard is. I don't
crispy.
Know if, crispy. Yes, crispy.
Crispy.
That's kind of a deadhead term or terminology.
I mean, people say that about shows all the time, but this one, it's genuinely like, so it sounds better than official release stuff. Like,
it really
does.
It's
excellent.
Yeah. And I also particularly, so the 93 tour, the guitarist was Drew Zing, and they actually replaced him. I don't know why, but the guitarist, and he only toured with this one for this 1 year, was 94. He got replaced after this, but George Wadenius, a Swedish guitar player. He's a great session guitarist. He, I was looking up some of his credentials. So he played on a lot of great, like, 70s and 80s soul and R&B stuff. He was the guitarist on Luther Vandross's Never Too Much, which, and for my money, is one of the greatest, like, songs ever. I absolutely love that song. So big ups to George Wadenius for that. And then he was also in a band called, he was in like a Swedish prog rock band called Made in Sweden. That I knew one of their songs, and I've enjoyed that song. Like, I put it on some playlist of mine from years back, and have always liked it. I had no idea it was the same guy who would later play up for Steely Dan. So
I'll follow the summer, I'll do the kind of thing I understand.
Yeah, I think he may be the single best live guitarist they've ever had. I mean, I do like all of them for different reasons. Some of them lean towards the more like shredding side of things. That would be Wayne Krantz, who was with them in the 90s. Some of them are kind of the more tastefully smooth variety. I would put John Harrington, who's been with them for a long time now. And I think he's still basically the sort of their main guy. But yeah, Wadenius was their guitarist for this one year. And I think he is just like, you know why I like him so much is because he's my favorite Steely Dan guitarist of all time is Larry Carlton. I like Larry Carlton is, you know, the best thing that happened when they brought him on for the Royal Scam is when things kicked up into the absolute upper echelon of
sure.
Legendary Steely Dan. And I think he's a big reason for that. And I feel like George Wadenius is the closest thing to Larry Carlton that they've ever had. It's just kind of something about the tone and style is similar. So
do we know? So I would assume Walt was, I mean, Don obviously is on the piano for this and singing. And so Wadenius is playing guitar and Walter is also playing guitar.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, like, because I know they call out Wadenius's solos a couple times, but I assume Walt is probably taking some of the solos himself and then Wadenius is taking other ones.
Yeah. I mean, they've always had this sort of dual guitar. So they always have Walt is one of the guitarists. And then they always have the like other guy who's like got more chops.
Sure. The hired gun.
The hired gun. Yeah. So in this, and basically, Walter. You know, Walter will solo on the songs that he actually did the solo for, you know, back on those, you know, original recordings. So I know he did the solo on Josie, on the actual Josie recording. The guitar solo is Walt. So when they do Josie live, it goes to Walt. Same with, what am I blanking on? Let's see what else. I think FM also is another one. Like Walter did the solo. Or there, you know, a lot of those songs, there are multiple guitar solos and Walt does one of them and then the hired gun did the other. So that's sort of the format they adopt, you know, they adopt here. There's also another pianist as well for most of these shows because
really
busy singing. Yeah. So Warren Bernhardt is doing the, a lot of the sort of, you know, more elaborate piano solos are him.
Got it.
Yep.
So can we talk about how the way that it begins is it's unconventional. It's like, this goes, I think, kind of what I was trying to say earlier about the way they approach their own material. It's like a medley. It's basically like, we know that you want this stuff and we're going to give it to you, but it's presenting it in a way that's, it's not, it feels like they're in control of how it's being shown, which is a subtle difference. And like the audience, I think, comes across, like, I think if anybody who's there would be stoked. Maybe you'd be a little disappointed that they don't play like the whole song as you would like, but I think that the effect is really nice, and it actually kind of sets you up to be a little bit more receptive, I think, maybe to the things they throw at you after that point.
Yeah, it's kind of setting the tone for the evening. And I like that they do these. They only did it for a couple of years, these instrumental medleys to open the show. They do like three songs in a row. I know this one they do. It's the Royal Scam into Parker's band into the Fez.
The Fez.
Yeah.
Fez.
You know, you want to hear the instrumental Fez.
You get most of it. You can fill in the words for yourself on that.
Oh, yeah. The Fez is all about that feeling. It's a song where you know what it's about, even if you don't hear the words.
It's also a way to deliver a few more of these songs that maybe they wouldn't have done otherwise, that, you know, you want to at least hear the instrumentals of. So, you know, they're maybe not going to do the full, you know, 8 or 9 minutes that the live version of the Royal Scam would, but they gave you a little taste, right?
Sure. Yeah. A little amuse-bouche here at the beginning of the show. Just wet your tongue. Boy, imagine a 9-minute extended jam on the Fez where they actually do. That is what, let's get Asia out of here. Let's get Peg out of here. Who gives a shit? I want to just hear him go wild on the Fez.
I went to a bachelor party weekend last year, and we all wore Fez caps, and we just played the Fez like just 100 times. Just like, it was just kind of always playing on a speaker somewhere. It's a good idea. You should all try to do that someday.
That song has a bachelor party feel to it, now that you mention it. Something about the sleaze of it, kind of. Yeah, you know, I never contextualized it that way, but now that you mention it,
it's also one of those songs where it's like, I found you can just play it again and again and again and again and again, and you'll kind of like lose track of when it ended, so you can kind of just indefinitely listen to it.
I guess there's some complicated moments in it, but at least in terms of the lyrics, it's one of the simplest songs they ever did, right?
Never gonna do without the Fez on.
And it's got that.
It's about a hat. It's a Fez. Right. It's in the title right there. It's about a hat.
Yeah.
They always leave multiple options for what these things can be.
Masters of the devil. Entendre.
If you want to go down the entendre route, you can. But if you want to just imagine a guy with a Fez, that's open to you as well.
Yeah. Would they do other medleys at the beginning of other shows, or was it always Royal Scam, Parker's band, the Fez?
No, there was another. So the previous year they did Royal Scam into Bad Sneakers into Asia.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So Asia would just get a medley.
To me, I would be a little upset I didn't get to see Asia in full.
Yeah.
And they rectified that in 94. So I think the 93, because that's the other one that I've heard of the medleys, because I think they cut these out. I don't know. They stopped doing that. I don't know why. I think this is a great idea, is to do these three song medleys. But Asia was relegated to the medley slot in the previous year. But then.
Yeah.
But that's a wild one to plug into a medley.
That's what I'm saying, though, is like, it's actually it's cool to me that they did that, because that's the type of choice. You don't get it as much on this show, because like, oh man, they didn't play Parker's band. Like, I'm furious. But Asia, you know, yeah, they did just let it be something other than a crowd pleasing chumming the waters moment. They it shows ownership over the material in a way.
Well, Asia is not a crowd-pleasing chumming the waters moment,
oh,
like Peg is. Asia is sure. Like virtuosic musicianship.
The, favorite,
the last like 3 or 4 minutes of that are just like an absolutely stratospheric, like all lights on the fucking band, just like unbelievable human talent up on stage.
Sure, but I mean, it is like the title track of like their most famous record.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a fan of Steely Dan,
I think it's a
what's
fan
the
fan.
Song that you most want? I mean, Asia's usually up there, right?
Yeah, I want to hear Asia when I go see Steely Dan.
Yeah,
I was actually surprised.
We
was
did
surprised.
See Steely Dan.
Did you?
Go ahead. Yeah, no, I saw him at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh,
I
good.
Saw him, Steely Dan.
The man himself?
Yeah, and actually, I went with my friend, and we were hooting and hollering so loud that like the people in front of us turned around and were mad. But by the end of the show, we knew more songs than they did. So, and they actually apologized. And I'm not lying to you. Like, they actually, like, it was a real role reversal moment. It was redemptive.
Yeah. Well, the first time I saw them, I was unsure of what they were going to play. I thought maybe they would just run through the standards, but they opened with Black Cow Into Asia. So they just, and I was very happy. Right,
that's
right,
not too
bed.
Bad.
Yeah.